of this community radio station, because there is so much more work to do. Thank you all. Be well, treat one another kindly, and I will speak with you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th. Thank you.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root this mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. That was Eric Bibb doing Mole in the Ground. This is Desiree Helligers, and I'll be your host this morning on KBOO Portland's Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. And clearly, we couldn't bring you the Old Mole without community support for KBOO. We're in the midst of our summer fund drive. To donate to KBOO, go to kboo.fm/give to make a one-time gift or become a monthly sustaining member. Alternately, you can click the red box donate in the mobile app or text KBOO to 44321. Alternately, you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. On today's show, Lori Mercier speaks to Usama Magdizi, a professor of history and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Berkeley. Magdizi's research focuses on the cultural and political history of the modern Middle East. They discuss Israel's genocide and the Magdizi Street podcast, which Usama co-hosts with brothers Sari and Karim Magdizi. The show is available through YouTube, other platforms, and Patreon. Then we hear a pre-taped interview with Mike Horner, Harlan Schober, and Ted Dreyer of PEST, the People's Equipment and Supply Team, about their wide-ranging organizing, from refurbishing a school bus into a mobile medical clinic for Standing Rock, to projecting slogans about ICE raids and the Gaza genocide on the sides of buildings, and refurbishing an old fire truck into the World on Fire truck. And they speak about the links between the climate crisis, U.S. imperialism, and the unfolding genocide in Gaza, and about the power of artivism, spectacle, and theatricality in movement work. First up, Laurie Mercier's interview with Osama Makhdizi.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Osama Makhdizi, a professor of history and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Berkeley, whose research focuses on the cultural and political history of the modern Middle East. Some of his publications include the books Artillery of Heaven, American Missionaries and the Failed Conversion of the Middle East, Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame and the Making of the Modern Arab World, and Faith Misplaced, The Broken Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations. With his brothers Sari and Kareem Makhdizi, he co-hosts the podcast Makhdizi Street, which you can find through YouTube, other platforms, and Patreon. Welcome to KABU, Osama Makhdizi.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Laurie.
Well, the Makhdizi Street podcast is fantastic political journalism that we want KABU listeners to know about. You and Sari and Kareem Makhdizi interview noted scholars, journalists, and human rights activists such as Sarah Leah Whitson, Avi Shlaim, Nora Erekat, and most recently, Basil Makhdizi, who provided a fascinating discussion of the importance of Palestinian football. How did you and your brothers, all academics, decide to enter the world of podcasts back in November 2023, I believe?
Well, I think thank you. That's a great question. And I think we often ask ourselves that as well. I mean, we started right after the genocide began, and we had been thinking about it or toying with the idea of starting a podcast, but we kept deferring and deferring and deferring. And then eventually, once the genocide began, and we were, of course, appalled by, as so many, I'm sure, of your listeners, and so many people around the world, we were appalled by the mainstream lack of fairness and any sense of justice or history or context of what was happening to the Palestinians. And so we decided to pool our knowledge, to pool our passion, to pool our sense of justice, and to start this podcast. And we think of it, honestly, less as political journalism and more as public scholarship, in the sense of trying to sort of bring in as many guests and also have discussions amongst the three of us, because we're, as you noted, we're three brothers. One who is in literature is his specialization. The other is in political economy and environmental studies, and me, I'm a historian, and so the three of us work together, and we all, in a sense, share the same basic outlines in terms of justice for Palestine and justice more generally. And we felt that it was important to get a focused, honest, contextually rich, and historically informed discussion of what was happening in Palestine. And we know, because we've all been working for decades, we know a lot of people in the field and outside, you know, so journalists, historians, scholars, public intellectuals, human rights activists, and even politicians. And so we've asked all these different people to be on the podcast, and we've had an extraordinary reception. At least we get to control what the questions are, and what kinds of questions get asked that center Palestinian history and humanity and context.
Yes, and you all bring such deep knowledge of not only Palestine, but the broader Middle East and U.S. foreign policy. And that is, as you say, just such important context to provide to listeners that I really don't know of any other podcast that provides that level of kind of intellectual context as well as debate, which I want to get to in a minute, because that I find is one of my favorite features of the podcast, how you and your brothers will analyze various guests and sometimes debate amongst yourselves what is to be done or you know, what any of the guests represent about the region and prospects for Palestine. In many ways, so much social media and so many podcasts such as yours, The Middle East Eye, journalists like Owen Jones and Chris Hedges, and activists like Katie Halper and Hassan Piker have all provided critical voices on behalf of Palestinians like we've never heard before. But these popular collective voices haven't seemed to penetrate mainstream media or U.S. policymakers, which have been incredibly dishonest in continuing to defend Israel. And we've seen no change or very little change in their coverage and policies. But somehow, majorities of populations, even in the U.S., oppose Israel's war. Do you think this growing popular support for Palestinians and greater outrage against Israel's madness have made or will make a difference?
I hope so. I mean, in the end, what we're seeing, of course, is the for all of us. It's for all of us. We are seeing the first live stream genocide in history. This has never happened before. I mean, there have been genocides in the past, and alas, I'm sure there will be genocides in the future. But this is the first genocide that's been live streamed on TikTok, on YouTube, on Instagram, on all the different social media platforms. And so people around the world, and we're talking about billions of people around the world, are seeing what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. And honestly, it's absolutely unacceptable, depraved, unconscionable, cruel, and disgraceful on the part of the Israeli government, on the part of all those in Israel and in the US and in the West who support this kind of outrageous violations of the most fundamental basic norms of human decency. I mean, the targeting of children, the starvation, literally the starvation of children as a deliberate policy, the killing, the massacres, the endless bombings of schools and hospitals and universities and shelters and bakeries, and most of all the cruelty of because it's all deliberate, it's all systematic policy. It's not like this is a one-day event or a one-off event. And I think people around the world can see all this and they're shocked. And I think it will, and I hope it has to make a difference. Otherwise, we're in very, very, very dark. We are, of course, in dark times, but we're heading towards even darker times if all this huge amount of collective outrage doesn't make a difference. And Laurie, what I see now is that it used to be, you know, people didn't know very much about the Palestinians, and even now, a lot of people who are outraged by the genocide are not necessarily sort of deep in knowledge about Palestine or the history of Palestine or what's happened or how did we get to where we are today, but just are at a more fundamental, basic human level are appalled by what is happening. And you're right, this huge amount of outrage, and we're talking about major figures. We're talking about major figures in sports, mostly outside the U.S., unfortunately, but also in the U.S. in terms of alternative social media. As you mentioned, a few of the figures here who are influencing and who are trying to make an impact, but also people like Jeremy Scahill, whom we had on the podcast, Ryan Grimm and others. A lot of people are can see what's happening on our appalled. It doesn't make a difference yet because in the US, as we know, the policymakers at the top, as well as the sort of, we can call them the nomenclatura or the elite, who run this country, don't often just ignore public opinion until they're absolutely forced to do a change. And that's where we are now with the question of Palestine. The U.S. policy under Biden and now under Trump is extraordinarily cruel and extraordinarily anti-Palestinian, and it's building on quite literally a century of U.S. policy that has been dismissive, not to say blatantly hostile, to Palestinian aspirations for a better life and for a more decent future.
I mean, I think the fact that the Trump administration has, well, along with university administrators, clamped down on protesters and really tried to silence and deport those who are criticizing U.S. policy suggests that, you know, they're really trying to stamp out this, you know, these powerful voices because they fear that change. But just recently,
but Laurie, could I say that? But they're building the Trump administration, as vile as these policies are in targeting students and in arresting people throughout this country. And again, not just Palestinians, but of course, this all began with the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil of Colombia, with the, as far as I'm aware, and as far as most of us can see, with the tacit complicity of or the tacit consent of the Columbia University administrators, who allowed this to happen, or have said very little, at the very least, have said very little in defense of their students, and in fact have enacted extraordinarily hostile policies towards any expressions of solidarity with the Palestinians. So it's not just the Trump administration, it's the Biden administration, it's university administrators before Trump came to power, and he's taking advantage, he and the right wing and the conservative movement in this, let's just say the right wing movement in this country, at least the right wing people in power right now, have taken advantage of the smearing, the consistent smearing by organizations like the ADL of our students of all faiths, by the way, to ram through a clear right wing agenda that's initially aimed at Palestinians and expressions of solidarity with Palestine, but of course is a much broader agenda.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, yes, under the Biden administration, you know, the Biden, of course, began this genocide and also so-called liberal college administrators completely complicit in trying to erase any kind of academic freedom or freedom of speech in criticizing Israel. And we see this here in Portland, and in fact, a local school board member in Beaverton has been under investigation for even acknowledging or expressing sympathy for Palestinians and acknowledging the genocide.
In our lifetime, we will be free. One day when the light shines, we will be free. In our lifetime, we will be free. And they can bury us, but they will find out we are seeds. Because I know of every massacre we suffered, the Nakba, Sabra, Shatila, and Rafah. My people have died a million times in the struggles till they rise from the tide like a rose through the rubble. I see God himself in the eye of a refugee who'd rather die.
That was Macklemore's Hens Hall featuring Anis, MC Abdul, and Amerzan. The song commemorates the Columbia University student uprising for Gaza and the life and death of 5-year-old Palestinian Hind Rajab, who was killed by Israeli Defense Forces after being trapped for hours in a car with 6 dead family members. Red Crescent Emergency Services spoke with Hind for hours while she awaited rescue before being killed, along with 2 ambulance drivers who were dispatched to rescue her. This is KBOO Portland. I'm Desiree Helgers, and I'm your host for today's Oldmore Variety Hour, where we're in the midst of our summer fun drive. You know you can count on KBOO to bring you courageous, uncensored coverage of what's going on in the Middle East and of the global movement to stop the unfolding genocide in Gaza and to free Palestine. To donate to KBOO, go to kboo.fm/give to make a one-time gift or become a monthly sustaining member. You can also click the red box Donate in the mobile app or text KBOO to 44321. That's text KBOO to 44321. Finally, you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. And now back to Laurie Mercier speaking with Osama Makdizi.
I remember when you and your brothers were debating whether Trump represented a break from the U.S. foreign policy establishment. I mean, I think that was maybe early in the administration and perhaps hoping or wishful thinking that there might be some change in U.S. policies. But Huckabee just, you know, echoed Trump the other day about millions of Palestinians are not only going to have to leave Gaza, but the West Bank. So I'm wondering, has your thinking changed about some of these debates that you all were having some months ago?
Well, I don't think, to be fair, I don't think we were debating the good intentions of the Trump administration, and certainly not people like Mike Huckabee, but not Donald Trump or any of the people in this administration. None of us have any sort of are under any illusions about just how anti-Palestinian this administration is. The question was, you know, to what extent is the Trump administration building upon what the Biden administration gave them in terms of a platform of genocide? And to what extent is there going to be a break insofar as Trump is ultimately not entirely ideological in the sense of, you know, he does what Trump wants to do. And he can, as we saw with Elon Musk, this whole sort of flip-flop with Elon Musk. I mean, these are sort of extremely, so we had, as I said, we have no faith. It's not that we have any faith in the positive intentions of any of these people. On the other hand, the situation in Gaza has gotten worse. And of course, but the point is it's been getting worse for decades, and then a massive escalation from October onwards. And it gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And more people are aware of this. And that's why you see so many different personalities in the public sphere, academics, but mostly sort of, I would say, also writers and journalists in the social media sphere that you refer to, sports personalities, even the manager of one of the largest clubs in the football clubs in the world, Manchester City, Pep Guardiola, graduation ceremony, spoke out. Miss Rachel, you know, in terms of on YouTube, there are all these people who are speaking out. And what's amazing is how many people are speaking out because of what is happening in Gaza, because it's so unconscionable, because what Israel is doing is so shocking and so depraved and so cynical and so deliberate. And that's the key point. It's deliberate. And at the same time, you have an extraordinarily right-wing government in this country building upon the democratic establishment that have green-lighted this genocide. And that's where we are.
Yes. And despite this live-stream genocide and universal condemnation of Israel by all human rights organizations, ICJ, the ICC, just the, you know, record bombing, the unprecedented targeting of journalists, scholars, aid workers, medical professionals. But yet, you know, I want to turn here to our academic organizations like the American Historical Association, which has resisted even something as basic as condemning scholasticide. But what do you make of historians and, I mean, of all people and professions who supposedly depend on evidence for their assessments, refusing to condemn U.S. support of Israel?
Well, I think
certainly it's not all historians, and yeah. You know, maybe you could talk about this controversy in the AHA.
Yes, I think it's important to sort of underscore that point, which is that the scholasticide for your listeners and viewers, scholasticide, of course, means the deliberate sort of destruction of the scholarly, the higher education, and the education system in Gaza. Israel has deliberately destroyed every single university in Gaza, and has, of course, targeted schools and has made learning and teaching impossible in Gaza. It's also killed administrators, it's killed teachers, it's killed students in Gaza over the past 2 years. And so, you know, historians are, many historians have been outraged. And of course, again, just to emphasize this point, it's not just Palestinian historians or historians who work on Palestine. It's ethical people who care deeply about the fact that history has been absolutely weaponized from the very beginning by Netanyahu and his crew. And of course, before Netanyahu, by the entire Zionist project in Palestine. History has been weaponized against the Palestinian people to claim that some people have more rights on this land than others based on religion, based on the fact that some people, you know, and excluding the indigenous native population of the Palestinians. And it's been a system of oppression that goes back to at least 1917, if not the Balfour Declaration, if not the mandate itself in the 1920s. And of course, the Nakba of 1948, there's a long history of this. And historians are deeply aware of this. And so a lot of the younger historians are appalled. A lot of the senior historians, I would say some of them are appalled. I should hope many more are appalled. But the leadership of the AHA, the American Historical Association, which is the flagship professional organization for historians working on history in the United States, took it extraordinarily. First of all, the membership there voted overwhelmingly to censure the scholasticide, to condemn the scholasticide, to condemn Israel's scholasticide of and the destruction of every university in Gaza. The leadership of the AHA, however, vetoed that democratic decision on the part of the membership. Not only did they veto it, they refused to put it to a vote, to a general vote to the entire membership. And so it showed the level of cowardice, the level of duplicity, the level of extraordinary disingenuousness on the part of those in power at the AHA. And because especially when one bears in mind that the American Historical Association condemned Russia immediately upon its invasion of Ukraine, but and
which claimed is hardly, that, you know, I mean, for all of its crimes, hardly a genocide.
Well, whatever it is, they still condemned it. The point is they condemned it right away. And the extraordinary thing is that they claimed, well, that is about history and the abuse of history. But with Israel, they said, no, you know, it's not about the abuse of history. Never mind Netanyahu's references to Amalek. Never mind Netanyahu's references to Judea and Samaria. Never mind the way Palestinians have been depicted as you know, primitive and savage and uncivilized and so on and so forth. Never mind the whole history of Western genocides against non-Western peoples, you know, and the, I mean, there's a whole thing. And so I think many younger scholars understand this. And what we see across the board in virtually all professions that I'm aware of is a generation shift, a massive tectonic generation shift. Younger people, by and large, don't buy the propaganda that is so utterly dehumanized Palestinians. Older scholars, more established scholars, those who crave power, those who want to be in positions of influence, understand and feel that there are certain, either they don't care about Palestinians, or they're just deeply anti-Palestinian, or they're just afraid, or they simply, you know, they do the calculations and they figure it's not worth it to take on those who are in favor of maintaining the status quo and maintaining this truly obscene anti-Palestinian discourse in the United States.
How have you fared at the University of California? I mean, what are your observations about solidarity among faculty in support of Palestinian rights?
Same. What I said earlier, I think, applies across the board. I think across the entire United States and probably across most of the Western world, in the sense that there is a generation shift taking place. There is a huge demand and thirst for knowledge. But as you said, as we started at the outset of this program, we've never seen this level of repression. Not in my lifetime, and I'm sure in your lifetime, we've never, ever seen this level of repression in the United States against students in this way. It's kind of absolutely shocking. It's absolutely, utterly shocking what's been happening. So students are understandably nervous about protesting now. But the amazing thing is how many students of all faiths have continued to protest, have continued to raise their voices, have continued to try to bring awareness to the genocide and to the complicity of many institutions in this country with the genocide. And what we've seen, in fact, is kind of shocking. We've seen a doubling down of denial across the United States, especially in official institutions. That are pretending. I mean, we can see what's going on now. There's this whole, what's happened is that the U.S., the Congress, have these hearings about anti-Semitism on our campuses, and they've literally sort of, you know, they have created this narrative that solidarity with Palestinians and protests against genocide is somehow anti-Semitism. And that's what they have said over and over and over again. And our administrators, by and large, have responded by being on the defensive. And this is, if I'm going to give them, you know, if one is going to be generous, by being on the defensive and by desperately trying to parry all these attacks on their institutions. And so what we see, by and large, is that younger generations no longer accept that there should be a Palestine exception, whereas those in power are adamant that they want to maintain the Palestine exception. In other words, make the Palestinians people who don't deserve equality, don't deserve history, don't deserve humanity, don't deserve rights, don't deserve liberation, and don't deserve ethical consideration.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Osama Makdizi. I really encourage listeners to check out the Makdizi Brothers podcast, Makdizi Street, available on YouTube, other platforms, and Patreon. And we'll look forward to hearing more from you. I hope, Osama, that you plan to continue these podcasts.
For the time being, we are. Yeah, thank you.
Well, we'll link to it and your other work on the Old Mole Variety Hour website on KBOO. Thanks again.
Thank you, Lori. You take care.
Still they know they can't shake us. $1 billion sword to the neck. Death cannot break us. And every Palestinian refugee holds a key. One day we will return, no matter how long it takes us.
In our lifetime, we will be free.
That was Macklemore's Hinds Hall featuring Anis, MC Abdul, and Emerson. And before that, you were listening to Lori Mercier's interview with Osama Makdizi. Next up, I speak with Harlan Schober, Mike Horner, and Ted Dreyer of PEST, the People's Equipment and Supply Team. But first, we're taking a quick break for our summer fun drive. KBOO Portland relies on community support to continue to bring you cutting-edge coverage of so many issues. To donate to KBOO, go to kboo.fm/give. To make a one-time gift or become a monthly sustaining member. You can also click the red box Donate in the mobile app or text KBOO to 44321. That's KBOO to 44321. Finally, you can mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland 97214. And now my pre-taped interview with Ted Dreyer, Harlan Schober, and Mike Horner about their artivist organizing at the intersections of climate justice and militarism. So I'm speaking this morning with Harlan Schober, Mike Horner, and Ted Dreyer of PEST, the People's Equipment and Supply Team, which garnered considerable visibility in 2016-2017 when it refurbished a school bus to serve as a mobile medical unit for Standing Rock. Most recently, you know, PEST has been involved in some of the most creative and interesting regional actions, from light projections on buildings condemning the unfolding genocide in Gaza to refurbishing an old fire truck into the World on Fire truck that's been used in, you know, multiple actions around Portland and beyond, including to resist the threatened expansion of Zenith Energy's capacity to transport and store volatile fuels in the critical energy infrastructure hub in Northwest Portland. So thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, glad to be here, Desiree.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Can you all talk a little bit about your organizing backgrounds and how those have informed the work that you did at Standing Rock and more recently at the intersections of climate justice and militarism? And maybe we can start with Mike.
The launching point for me was, for my Portland activism, was the trip to Standing Rock, where Harlan and I sort of joined forces and rented a truck and loaded it up with stuff and went to see what was happening there. And also I went to the Philippines on a human rights mission there with the local PCHIRP and ICHIRP group, and spent 10 days in the Philippines and was at the inauguration of Duterte in 2016. And, you know, and it's all sort of just taken off from there.
I hadn't been politically active until around the time of Standing Rock. I'd been going to a few meetings, but there was something really compelling about the Standing Rock occupation. We met people there from all over the place. The first person I talked with was an indigenous guy who traveled from Peru to be at Standing Rock. There was a groundswell of enthusiasm for that. So we outfitted a school bus with insulation and a heater and a bunch of bunks and took it there for people to use. Came back. We were, in fact, outfitting it during the Trump election the first time in 16. And we did a second bus, and then since then have done spotlight things with gobos, putting words and pictures on walls with light. And then in 2020, we got a hold of the school bus that XR had acquired, and we've been running that ever since.
Fire truck.
Yeah, thank you. The transition from school buses to fire trucks. Yeah.
You started by outfitting the school bus for a medical clinic at Standing Rock?
Well, I'd say we hoped it would be used as a medical clinic. What we built in was just a number of bunks. I think it had 8 bunks in it. And we insulated it, and we provided a propane heater that could at least try to keep the space warm in the North Dakota winter. We understand it got, even with that heater running full blast, it got really cold in there. And we donated it to one of the clinics operating at Standing Rock. We brought that one back from Standing Rock when things wound down there. And we had 2 buses at that point. And one of them we donated to an indigenous group that was doing herbal medicine, and they would follow the canoe journey every year.
Yes.
So they followed that. And the other bus was donated to another indigenous group, and I don't know what use it's been put to.
Ted, do you want to jump in and talk a little bit about your own organizing background?
Sure, thank you. So I've been an activist since 1968 when I participated in the demonstrations basically against the Vietnam War outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Since I retired as a public school teacher, I had more time, so I participated in Portland's version of Occupy Wall Street. I worked with Greenpeace for a while, and I have been on the board of a couple of predominantly Native American groups, and therefore I was really interested in the Standing Rock demonstrations. And when I found out that Harlan and Mike were creating a bus to go to Standing Rock, I signed up immediately and was delighted to be able to accompany them both on the 3 trips that we took.
Thank you. And I mean, I just want to double back a little bit also to Mike, your organizing history, right? Because I know that you also, you served in the Vietnam War, you're involved with Veterans for Peace. You worked also in prosthetics, right? I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, those links and sort of, how you make these connections to climate justice.
I started out activism in the 70s against the Seabrook nuclear plant, and then I lived in Maine at the time. So, and also against the Maine Yankee plant in Maine. And, but in that time, the Veterans for Peace was being initially organized by a couple of vets near Portland, Maine. And I happened to go with a fellow that I was in business with to one of their meeting, to their almost their first meeting. And I found that they were bringing kids, the organization was bringing kids over from Bosnia. And this was during the Bosnia-Herzegovina war. And there were, of course, as always, there were lots of people getting blown up and a lot of children getting blown up and needing surgery and operations and prosthetics and whatnot. And then in 1994, I pulled up stakes and left Maine and went to Spokane to go to school for prosthetics and orthotics technician stuff, which basically involves building arms and legs and braces. So all along the way, everything I read, everything I knew, the casualties and the people that suffered traumatic injuries, you know, besides being run over by their grandfather's lawnmower, mostly are war time, you know, trauma. You know, after coming back from the Vietnam War, I was appalled, you know, by what I had seen and what I had done, you know, or what I had been part of. And from then on, it was really, I was looking differently at the military and what it meant. And the more I learned about the military and just how wide ranging it was and how destructive it was and how polluting it was, it just became kind of a no-brainer to oppose the largest military in the world, and clearly a military that was not serving the people. It was not supporting anything but capitalist expansionism.
Capitalism, of course, is based on endless monetary expansion. The stock market has to continually increase and increase. And the only way it can do that is by ignoring the needs of human beings and life on the planet altogether. Examples of racism are, unfortunately, all over the place. We dehumanize certain groups, but basically capitalism is dehumanizing every human being and all living things, so that Ashley Dawson, for example, in a great history of extinctions that he published in 2016, says capitalism is the main cause of the sixth great extinction. And other scholars like Richard Smith have come to the same conclusion, so that there is an immediate connection between capitalism and racism and extinction. And because all of this is coming to a head as capitalism reaches a sort of crisis, because it's impossible to keep expanding, it resorts more and more to brute military force. And we see that in an extreme case in the USA enthusiastically supporting genocide in Israel, but also now sending troops to Los Angeles. That brute reliance on military force has always been present, but it's becoming more and more transparent and harder, I hope, for many people to ignore, as we see that military expansionism projected against now our own people right here at home.
El derecho de vivir sin miedo en nuestro país.
En conciencia y unidad con toda la humanidad.
Ningún cañón borrará el surco de la hermandad.
That was an all-star lineup of Chilean artists singing Victor Jara's El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, or The Right to Live in Peace. Jara was tortured and killed in the wake of the U.S.-supported coup that resulted in the assassination of the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende and installed the fascist dictator Augusto Pinochet. And now we return to my pre-taped interview with Mike Horner, Harlan Schober, and Ted Dreyer of Pest.
Both Ted and Mike had been involved in actually doing something about these things much longer than me. But it's been apparent to me for most of my life that we're kind of all on this collective rocket sled ride, and the brick wall is getting closer and closer. So there's that general unease. So this activism for me is kind of self-serving. It's an antidote to despair. And we've got this immense climate crisis that's already in motion. And now we're diverting the attention to some extent because we have this constitutional crisis with the orange felon trying to take over the whole business. And I think that's our primary duty right now, is to fill the streets, write to the people that can be written to. I mean, we've all made the commitment to nonviolence. So the current constitutional catastrophe is kind of front of mind for almost everyone I know. And we just want to encourage everyone to get in the streets and show up.
Kind of wanted to back up for a minute to talk a little bit about your projection work specifically, right? And, you know, recently you all came and gave a talk as part of the Thin Green Line is People's History Project Speakers Bureau, right? You came and gave a talk at Many Nations Academy and brought the fire truck and showed these high schoolers kind of the work that you're doing. Originally, the painting of the school bus that went as a medical clinic to Standing Rock was done at NEA, and that was done, I think the main artist was Asa Wright. Is that right? Who happened to have a relative in among the high schoolers that you are speaking to at Many Nations. So that was kind of an interesting connection there. Some of your projection now is really about Gaza. And I think, you know, I just want to say too, I think there's some really obvious connections between, Mike, your work as a prosthetic technician and the production of, you know, what Jasbir Puar calls the production of debility in Gaza, right? The fact that, you know, in addition to the incredibly high body counts, there are massive numbers of people losing limbs, right? So this enormous profit that's being generated by the war machines at the expense of, you know, living, breathing folks in Gaza, including the many, many children losing their limbs and as well as their entire families.
We now have a tradition of going to Fleet Week with our projections, and we put messages on the side of the boats, which, you know, the powers that be are not terribly happy about. But the so far, we haven't been arrested, and that's good. We were at the New Year's celebration at Pioneer Square this year, and they had the big drone show, you know, and all that stuff. So we brought our own drone-themed gobo there to project, which, you know, showed a picture on the wall of a family, like a mom, kid, and a dad, and they were all in the crosshairs of some sort of a weapon. And the title was Israeli Drones Kill Kids, because Israeli drones are actually target children and shoot them in very specific ways, in the head, you know, in the chest, you know, in ways that are not accidental. So we wanted to bring that out while this crowd was celebrating with the oohs and ahs of this, you know, sort of fancy light show in the sky. And, you know, we got overwhelmingly supportive comments. We had a few people tried to disrupt us, but then the police tried to shut us down, but we didn't go. We have lots of critical messages about stop arming Israel. You know, stop mass starvation is a crime, is a war crime. Bombing hospitals is a war crime. These are things that should be obvious. And we also do a lot of light projection around immigration. You know, a lot of this stuff that's going on with ICE has happened before. And we have a whole stack of gobos about immigration issues and stuff, which are getting dusted off now and brought back out. There's a huge need for things like light projection because it's startling. It gets people's attention, just like the fire truck.
Too, I know you all were a regular fixture at Occupy ICE, like projecting on, you know, I don't know if it was directly on the ICE Center, on the building across the street. Like, what is it about light projection that is so exciting? I mean, that you can turn the side of a ship into you know, medium for your message.
Believe me, we talk a lot about messaging and just how to make sure that we're not projecting messages that only speak to the choir. It's always good to try and take a fresh look at your message and make sure that it's something that a Joe going down the street or a Jill going down the street will immediately recognize is something that they can relate to. We have a large group of people that we talk to. Our friend Ken Huey is a graphic artist and a comic guy. He does comics. He's a very good thinker. He's really good on messaging. The art of the message is really the art that I'm interested in.
Yeah, Harlan, you were going to jump in.
Sure. We've been helped a lot by a friend who is a professional sign painter, and Mike has learned lettering and layout and does many hand-built banners, some of them quite large. The banners that we use on the fire truck are like 20 feet long by 4 feet high. The newer ones are 10 feet long by 5 foot high. This may be a chance to put in a plug. We would always like to work with new volunteers who would like to go out at night and put light on the wall, or volunteers who would like to come along and help paint banners and possibly ride on the fire truck. We try to dispatch with a crew of two instead of just one driver. I think that we should call ourselves sloganistas.
I wonder if we can just, you know, pivot and talk more specifically about the World on Fire truck and sort of how y'all ended up buying a used fire truck and turning it into this incredible organizing tool.
Well, Extinction Rebellion Portland acquired this truck in 2019, and we used it one time that year. And then for a number of reasons, it was not being much used. It was basically given to Mike and me, Pest at the time, and we got it in 2020. And we were driving around our first time out with a banner on it, vote like your house is on fire, because we'd had those big fires. And we got a text by phone that there was a Black Lives Matter march in Lake Oswego. We showed up there and we found ourselves corking for the march. And it really took off from there.
For those who are unfamiliar with that term, corking, can you define that for us?
Yeah, thank you. Especially with the George Floyd protests in 2020, which were just large and constant and really inspiring, there developed in Portland a whole team of people who would control traffic so that marchers could occupy streets and no one got run over, and we could deal with traffic conflicts. And that population of people who use bicycles, motorcycles, and cars to control traffic to protect a march, they got really good at it. And we would get used as, in the fire truck, we would get used to usually take up the rear and claim a lane or two so that vehicle traffic couldn't overtake pedestrians.
Ted, did you want to kind of jump in a little bit?
If I can go back to the importance of the light images, just briefly at least, I just wanted to add that during the Black Lives Matter protest, which got, as everybody remembers, pretty crazy, the importance in that chaos of having these amazing images projected right on the Multnomah County Justice Center, so that you have, you know, images of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter right up there, enormous images, and the police who were, you know, shooting people with projectiles and other flying, exploding items and tear gas, couldn't do anything about. They couldn't reach up and erase those images. It was really moving and inspiring. I remember a couple of times that Mike and I grabbing the projector and running because the tear gas got too intense. But basically, it was the effect of art in this case is really inspiring and motivating, and it's quite impressive. And of course, the fire engine in its way serves the same purpose. So many times before a demonstration even starts, people will come up to the fire engine and ask about it. What is this? It fascinates people. It attracts people. And in action, moving along with a march or on the edge of a demonstration, it also has the same inspiring effect. It gathers people's attention. It focuses their attention. It inspires them. And it excites them because it's so unusual.
Okay, and you can have like massive, you know, the massive capital that it takes to build this building, right? And you all kind of occupy it visually in some startling, uncontrolled ways. Can you talk a little bit about other kind of artivist traditions that you might be drawing on?
In this last year, we've done puppets. So there was a 350 put on a class and brought Donovan Zimmerman, came from, I think, North Carolina. And he's been for 30 some years making puppets for street demonstrations and such. So we're trying to fold these things together. Now we have puppets that we can get a hold of, that some of them take six people to operate. Some of them are single person puppets, but they're kind of larger than life things. And we were in the St. John's Parade this year, for example, with the fire truck and people with puppets and a band on top of the fire truck and with banners and slogans. And it was a festive day. The music was festive. The messages were good. And the puppets are really elevating. They're almost all fanciful creatures, like a large crane and a fish with a jaw that opens and closes and the tail wags. And altogether, there's a lot of artistry going into these messages.
I feel like for bannering and stuff, inflatables like Backbone Campaign out of Vashon Island, you know, they were instrumental in the Kayaktivist thing, which has since become a thing in Portland. They've sort of pioneered the net banners, you know, that I think are brilliant and very easy to handle. And they make large banners possible to do on the water, which is pretty cool because otherwise you're just in big trouble with a big sail. They have pioneered a lot of fabulous techniques for getting messages out, you know, and they do light projection. Seems to me they may have been the ones that introduced us to light projection, Bill Moyer, I think. And then they also do inflatables. They put together these sort of coordinated shows, you know, if they show up a place and it's nighttime and they can do lights and it's about whales, they'll bring an inflatable whale. They are also into big props. And I think big props are the way to go. I consider the fire truck to be a big prop. You know, it's out of the ordinary. I consider light projection to be a big prop because it grabs attention.
Yeah, and I know Bill Moyer comes at it from a background in theater, right? So you really are bringing like this theater into the streets. And, you know, there is that very long tradition of that. So, you know, your work is just so interesting. It brings so much energy to the movement. And I know, Harlan, you mentioned earlier that you all are open to sort of training up new organizers, you know, having people ride along. You've got this bandstand now on top of the truck. Yeah, how can people get in touch and find out how they can plug in and support your work and maybe learn light projection?
We have now a Facebook page dedicated to the fire engine primarily. And we do have a web page. The World on Fire Department is the name of our web page.
All right. Well, thank you all so much. Good morning. This is Desiree Hilligers, and I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You were just listening to my pre-taped interview with Harlan Schober, Ted Dreyer, and Mike Horner of Pest. You've been tuned into KBOO Portland. We're in the midst of a summer fun drive, and you can donate by going to kboo.fm/give to make a one-time gift or become a monthly sustaining member. Or you can also click the red donate box in the mobile app or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a check to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. So that brings us to the end of today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. A shout out to Lori Mercier and our guest, Osama Makdizi, Professor of History and Chancellor's Chair at the University of California, Berkeley, and host of the Makdizi Street podcast. And thanks also to Fran Michelle for wrangling moles and behind-the-scenes technical assistant. And I'm going to play out today's show with more of Victor Jara's El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, The Right to Live in Peace, sung by an all-star Chilean lineup.
Con respeto y libertad y un nuevo pacto social que no haya desigualdad.
Sentimiento.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.